Hi, you're listening to Screen the Crime, a podcast where we talk about true crime and what would happen if your favorite TV and movie characters committed those crimes. I'm Maggie, and today my guest is...
Cameron, that's me. A local artist, anyone, so hire me. And a human roach, and I go to UCF.
Cameron is my friend from Florida. And she goes to UCF. Are you excited to go back to school?
I would be, but we're not, so...
You're not going back to school?
I don't know. For like one class, but it's looking bleak. Probably gonna cancel the first day.
You guys do have 388 cases already.
Yeah. That's only like a few people though.
Only just a few. All right, let's get into the case, I guess, then. So today, I'm going to be talking about the Bain family murders. So this is a family...
I love a good family annihilation.
Family annihilation. So you know what that means? Would you like to explain what that means?
Yeah. I mean, family annihilation, just, like, killing the whole family. I usually hear it in reference to, like, father like killing the whole family and then himself, but I guess it could be like outside people.
This one's actually the only person that survived is the son, so let's talk about it. All right, so
main character
main character tech, it's me. Okay, let's talk about David Cullen Bain. He was born on March 27th in 1972 to Margaret Arwa and Robin Irving Bain. Soon after he was born, his family moved to the outback of Papua New Guinea, and then in 1988, they returned to New Zealand. So this is a New Zealand crime.
Ooh.
I know. Once back in New Zealand, David joined school choir and went on to university, which was encouraged by his parents. However, he dropped out of university and was on unemployment, but he also worked at Opera Live for a period of time before he returned to university to study classical music and professional voice training lessons. So that's him. So now we're going to talk about the killings. On the morning of June 20th, 1994, David got back from his paper route and he found five members of the Bain family shot dead. So the victims were Robin Bain, who was 58, Margaret, who was 50, their daughter Arwa, who was 19, Lynette, who was 18, and their son Stephen, who was 14. So David called 111, which is the 911 in New Zealand, at 7:09 a.m., and he seemed very distressed. The rest of the morning's happenings are being disputed because some people say David killed the whole family and some people don't. But 4 days after the murders, David Bain, who was 22, was charged by the police with the murder of his family. And then on July 5th, 1994, the New Zealand Fire Services burned down the house the murders took place in at the request of the trustees of the Bain Family Trust and with David's permission. So this whole episode is really going to be the trial, but I'll try to keep it lively. The three-week trial took place at the Dunedin High Court in May of 1995 and was presided over by the late Justice Neil Williamson. Here's the prosecution's theory, and this is from crime.co.nz. So David wakes up around 5 a.m., he gets dressed and goes to his wardrobe and pulls out a .22 rifle. I feel like I said that one wrong. It's just a gun. He pulled out a gun, and he unlocked the trigger guard and then attached the silencer and loads a 10-round magazine. He takes a pair of white gloves from a drawer and puts them on, and he wears a pair of his mother's glasses because his are being repaired. And I guess they're the same prescription. He goes into his sister Lynette's room, which is the study, where he shoots her twice in the head as she lies sleeping. He goes to his mother's room and shot her in the forehead. In the room of his mother's, he finds Stephen asleep. He puts the rifle to his head, but Stephen wakes up and pushes it away as it goes off. There's a struggle with Stephen bleeding from a scalp wound as he fights for his life. David twists Stephen's t-shirt to strangle him, and as he lies on the floor gasping, David finishes him off with a bullet to the head. During the struggle, David's glasses have fallen off. He turns on the light and picks them up, leaving one of the lenses on the floor, and carries them back to his bedroom and places them on his chair. He goes downstairs where his sister, Arwa, has heard the shots and is praying for help, which, bad move on her part. She's kneeling as
yeah,
David...
Yeah, like, use your legs and run.
I know, right? She's kneeling as David enters the room, and he shoots but misses as he cannot see without his glasses. He shoots again, this time the bullet penetrates Arwa's forehead, killing her. He goes back upstairs where he hears Lynette gurgling, and he shoots her again in the top of the head. David throws his bloody clothing into the washing machine and turns it on. David's father, Robin, is still asleep in the caravan. David puts on a fresh set of clothes and goes out with his dog, Casey, to do his Otago Daily Times paper run. Returning home, he goes into the lounge and turns the computer on. He types in the suicide message ostensibly from his father to him saying, quote, "Sorry, you are the only one who deserves to stay." David hides behind the curtain with the rifle and waits for his father to come in to pray, a daily morning routine. Robin enters the room and kneels on the other side of the curtain. David shoots his father in the head, and leaving the rifle beside his body, David dials 111. Does it sound like he did it?
So in that scene, it's the son setting up the father to have been the killer?
Yes.
Or
so there is a message written on the computer from the father, Robin, that says, "Sorry, you are the only one who deserves to stay." And that's why David's the survivor. But he's setting up his father to be the murderer, saying that the reason David's alive is because the father said, only David deserves to be alive. David's own story was that he got up at his usual time, put on his running shoes and the yellow newspaper bag, and went on his paper run with the dog. Wait, before I continue, I just want to state that they're trying to say that David killed his entire family except for his father, changed his clothes, went on his paper run, then came back to kill his father. It just feels like in the time he was on his paper run.
Is his father narcoleptic? There was like 6 shots.
The father was sleeping in the caravan, which I believe to be like a car or a trailer. They were having issues in the romantic life of the mother and father.
All right.
So I don't think he was in the house.
On the benefit of the doubt.
But like, it's just saying like, he like went on his paper run while leaving the body of everyone there, hoping that his father didn't walk in before he wrote the suicide note. It's just like, it feels unrealistic, but I'll keep going. Sorry. So he got the yellow newspaper bag and went on his paper run with the dog. He arrived back about 6:42 to 6:43 a.m. Entered by the front door, went to his room. He took off the newspaper bag and his shoes there, then went downstairs to the bathroom where he washed his hands, black from the newsprint. He put some colored clothes in the machine, including the sweatshirt worn on his paper run over the last week, and set it to going. He went back upstairs to his room. Turning on the light, he then noticed bullets and the trigger lock on the floor. He went to his mother's room, finding her dead, then visited the other rooms where he heard Lynette gurgling and found his father dead in the lounge. He was devastated and rang the emergency number in great distress. So, now you've heard the prosecution's proposal for the theory. Here's the defense's from the same website. If it was accepted that David Bain did not kill his family on June 1994, that morning, then who did? There seems to only be one other possibility, the one favored at least during the earliest stages of the investigation, that Robin Bain murdered his wife, Margaret, and his daughters, Lynette and Arwa, then his son, Stephen, before shooting himself. A message was left on the computer, allegedly from him, for David, saying, "Sorry, you're the only one who deserves to stay." Theorists point to what they said. What they say are compelling facts to substantiate this scenario. They say Lynette returned home that weekend to confront her parents with her father's alleged incest with her over several years. Bane could have been looking at serious criminal charges.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
What was that charge?
It was incest.
With who?
Her father. Yeah, I know.
Maybe I do be seeing... Well, no, why would he kill the mother? We just kill the father.
No. Oh, you mean like if David was just like...
Yeah, I was just like...
He killed this whole family. Yeah, it wouldn't make sense. Bane could have been looking at serious criminal charges if that had been true and had it been reported to the authorities, giving him a motive. They say Robin's marriage to Margaret was essentially over, with Robin living in a schoolhouse at Tayari Beach during the week and a shabby caravan outside the family home on weekends. Not all bloodstains on Robin's clothes were analyzed before the trial, and supporters say there is a possibility some could have come from other family members. If so, this would have severely damaged the prosecution's case and strengthened the evidence against Robin. The firearm discharge residue test, which indicates the presence of gunpowder on people who have recently fired a gun, was not carried out on Robin until 5 hours after the police arrived. This may have made the test inconclusive, as residue can disappear within hours of a shooting. In addition, instead of the tests being done at the scene, they were carried out at the mortuary after the body had been moved without the hands being protected. Robin had 6 recent injuries to his hands. There were 20 empty cartridge shells in Robin's caravan, indicating that Robin had access to and had used David's rifle on previous occasions. Here's a note. Some of the issues were addressed and discounted by police investigating the original investigation. They were also rejected by the Court of Appeal. So on May 29, 1995, after a 3-week trial, David Bane was convicted by the jury on 5 counts of murder. On June 21, 1995, Justice Neil Williamson sentenced him to life imprisonment with 16 years non-parole period. Bane has maintained his innocence, and his supporters conducted a lengthy campaign to have his case reheard. An initial appeal to New Zealand Court of Appeals was dismissed in 1995, and the Privy Council declined to hear his appeal in 1996. The Police Complaints Authority reviewed the police investigation into the Bane family murders in 1997 and issued a 123-page report supporting its conduct. So this is all about trying to get him retrialed. After Bane's petition, the Governor General for a pardon, the Ministry of Justice held a further inquiry from 1998 to 2000, which found no miscarriage of justice. However, the Minister of Justice, Phil Goff, advised the Governor General to seek the Court of Appeals' view on 4 items of evidence. The Court of Appeals found there was sufficient cause to reconsider the case, which they did in 2003, again dismissing Bane's appeal. Bane then appealed to the Privy Council for a second time. In 2006, the Privy Council agreed to hear Bane's appeal against the verdict of the Court of Appeals, and his hearing took place over 5 days in March of 2007. Thursday, May 10, 2007, the Privy Council quashed David Bane's murder conviction, concluding that, quote, a substantial miscarriage of justice has actually occurred, unquote, while noting nothing in this judgment should influence the verdict in any way. They recommended a retrial, with the Solicitor General of New Zealand later confirmed it would take place. So here are the findings from the Privy Council. The emergence of much new evidence after the trial led to the later appeal and eventual overturn of Bane's conviction pending a retrial. 9 of the most important items were reviewed by the Privy Council, and here are their findings. So Robin Bane's mental state. The jury did not know that he was a miscarriage of justice in the initial trial.
Yeah.
The jury did not know that he was, quote, quite seriously disturbed and had reportedly hit a student at the school where he was principal and had published brutal and sadistic children's stories in the school's newsletter, one of which involved a serial murder of a member of a family. The second one is motive. Lynette had apparently told a friend just before the killings that she was planning to confront her parents that weekend about an incestuous relationship between her and her father, Robin. But the trial judge had ruled that the friend's evidence was admissible because he saw it was unreliable. The jury therefore never heard about this possible motive for Robin. The exclusion of this evidence was the principal question in the first appeal. Since then, two other people have come forward saying that Lynette had told them about the incest, and the other two had given supporting statements. The next one is the size of a bloody sock print. So prints from a right sock impregnated with blood was detected using luminol in Margaret's room, going in and out of Lynette's room, and in the hallway outside Margaret's room. They all seem to be from the same foot, measuring at 280 millimeters in length. These were in place where Robin would not have gone under the Crown's theory of events. It was accepted during the trial that the prints were David's and that the prosecutor summed up saying that they were too big to be Robin's. The jury was not told Robin's feet were measured at 270 millimeters in length, which is just 10 millimeters off from the sock print. Later measurements showed David's feet to be 300 millimeters in length, which is 20 millimeters off from the sock print. According to the Privy Court Counsel, the new evidence throws real doubt on the assumption during the trial that the prints could not have been Robin's. Another one is the time the computer was switched on. The jury was told that and later reminded by the judge that the computer was turned on at precisely 6:44 a.m. just after David had returned home. However, the exact time was not precisely recorded. The computer advisor employed by the Otago University determined the time that the computer was switched by identifying how long it had been going and what the current time of day was. However, he was not wearing a watch himself and relied on the watch of an accompanied constable, D.C. Anderson. The constable's watch had no second hand and only 5-minute intervals, divisions, and later upon examination appeared to be 2 minutes fast. Which I feel like if you're the computer analyst, you should be wearing a watch, but that's just me.
You think that.
Yeah, you think.
There's a lot going wrong in the investigation.
During the Privy Council appeal, both sides agreed that the computer could have been turned on as early as 6:39 with 49 seconds a.m. Another one is the time David returned home. Someone was seen by a passing motorist entering the gate at 65 Every Street at 6:45. The reliability of this time was left more doubtful than necessary in the minds of the jury because they were not told that the police had checked the car's clock, nor were they, or the defense, told of a second statement made by the motorist in which she mentioned that she saw the yellow paper bag over his left shoulder, which confirms that it was probably David. The ownership of the glasses. The jury heard a statement from an optometrist that glasses found in David's room were David's, conflicting with David's testimony that they were his mother's. David was then cross-examined about this in a way that raised doubt over his credibility. The optometrist had in fact changed his mind shortly before testifying and believed his statement had been changed to say they were the mothers, but this had not happened. The jury asked a question about this issue after retiring, and they were reminded of the conflicting testimony by the judge. The Privy Council concluded that while the ownership of the glasses was not a vital matter in itself, the conflicting evidence may have detracted from David's credibility in the eye of the jury. The left-hand lens. The left-hand lens of these glasses were found in Stephen's room. During the trial, Detective Weir testified that it was found there in the open. This was more consistent with the Crown's case that it had become dislodged during the struggle there than what is now accepted, that it was found under a skate boot under a jacket and was covered in dust. This may have misled the jury. David's bloody fingerprints on the rifle. David's fingerprints were found on the rifle, impressed there by bloody fingers. During the trial, it was assumed that this was human blood, because other blood on the rifle was definitely human. A test of the fingerprint blood afterwards did not test positive for human DNA, and the prints may have resulted from possum or rabbit shooting months beforehand. Lynette's gurgling noise. The jury was told that only the murderer could have heard Lynette's gurgling. Okay. The second court of appeal heard some contradicting evidence and concluded that it was not so clear-cut. The third court of appeal decided that it was, but was criticized by the Privy Council for having stepped outside its reviewing role here. The Privy Council concluded that the third court of appeal had exceeded its role as a reviewing body in deciding the implications of all this new evidence. The council also addressed three points which the third court of appeal had relied on in confirming David's guilt. Knowledge of a spare key to rifle, the bloody rifle clearer around David's fingerprints, and a spare magazine standing upright. They found that the implications at the first point were contentious, while the other two should have been decided by a jury instead of the appellate court. They felt that they did not need to consider a detail several other contagious points that the third appeal court saw as pointing towards David's guilt, including blood on David's opera gloves, Stephen's blood being found in David's black shorts, the timing of the washing machine cycle, David's head injury, and Robin's full bladder. I don't like that bladder.
Okay. I don't like that.
I don't like that. Although the Privy Court said Bain should be kept in custody, he was released on bail on May 5th, 2007. Following a hearing at the Christ Church High Court, more than 100 people attended, with the gallery erupting in cheers following the judge's decision. It was ruled that Bain posed no threat of offending if released, and he was bailed to live with one of his longest supporters, former All-Black Joe Karam, but later moved to West Auckland. All-Black is in all caps. I'm assuming it's an organization.
Yeah, I was like, what?
Yeah, he was part of the All Black. I don't know what that is, though. Retrial. The retrial was announced in June 21st, 2007 by Solicitor General Dave Collins. The decision to conduct a retrial was based on a series of factors, including the seriousness of the crime and the time Bain had spent in prison and the availability of witnesses and exhibits. The Solicitor General also declared that any further public discussion of the evidence or other matters that might influence a jury could be considered contempt of court. Various appeals and applications have since been made to the court in the conduct of the trial. So let's go to the court. Some witnesses from the original trial had died and many of the exhibits had been lost or destroyed. Both sides appealed to the court appeal against high court decisions on the admissibility of various pieces of evidence. The Court of Appeals decided that some items should be presented to the jury and suppressed any mention of these until after the verdict. These included statements from two high school friends of David, told them in 1989 how he could commit a sexual offense against a woman jogger and used his paper route as an alibi. By arriving at the usual time at some houses where he was often seen, but delivering to other houses much earlier. Evidence was also suppressed from a friend of Arla Bain that David Bain had been intimidating the family with his gun, later to be used in the murder. Bain's lawyer also appealed to the Supreme Court against the High Court decision about new evidence being presented at the retrial. They won their appeal, so the disputed evidence was excluded from the retrial and was under a suppression order until the week after the verdict, when the evidence and the reasons for its suppression was released. The disputed evidence was about a portion of the recordings of David's 111 call in which he was audibly breathing heavily at the time. A detective reviewed it in 2007 in preparation for the retrial, believed he heard the words, quote, "I shot the prick." Expert witnesses agreed that it was unclear whether the sounds were in fact speech, and if so, what Bain may have said. For instance, one expert suggested he might have said, "I can't breathe," and another expert gave the analogy of an image glimpsed in the clouds. Given the uncertainty and the expert's caution about presenting it to a jury, the Supreme Court decided allowing it as evidence would be unfairly prejudicial. The opening statements. David pleaded not guilty. Crown Prosecutor Bates told the jury that the evidence showed David killing his family evidence as circumstantial but strong. He said the Crown case should show that the father, Robin Bain, was not the killer. He laid out the case against David, describing graphically that the police found at the scene, what the police found at the scene, and how this was consistent with David killing each of his family members in turn. David had called 111 at about 7:10 a.m. When the police arrived at 7:30 a.m., they found him hysterical in his room, wailing, "They are all dead." His brother Stephen had clearly put up a struggle while bleeding profusely from an initial glancing scalp wound. Stephen was strangled with a t-shirt, then killed by another gunshot. Bates said David had injuries consistent with the struggle and had Stephen's blood on his clothes. A lens from the glasses David was wearing was found on the floor of Stephen's room, Bates said, and the frame and other lenses were found in David's room. David's bloody gloves were found in Stephen's room. And Bates said he must have had to remove them to deal with the rifle misfeeding or jamming on a bullet. According to Bates, Robin would have no reason to wear gloves if he intended to commit suicide. David had told the police he heard his sister Lynette gurgling, which Bates said meant he was present between her second gunshot wound and the final shot to her head, which had killed her. His other sister, Arwa, and his mother were both killed by a shot to the head. Robin was found in the lounge, lying on his side between a coffee table and a beanbag, dead from a single shot to the head. Next to him was a .22 caliber rifle, but his fingerprints were not found on it. Both the rifle trigger lock and his key were found in David's room. Bates said the state of the laundry was consistent with David trying to destroy evidence, especially the green jersey he wore during the killings. Doing his paper round was meant to provide David with an alibi. Bates argued that he had been sure to be seen along his route. Evidence would also be presented of conversations between David and his friends 6 days before the murder, when he told her he had a feeling, quote, something horrible would happen. After the killings, he told her they were what he had told her about before. It kind of seems like David killed him. You know, when I first wrote these notes, I was like, maybe David didn't. But it kind of seems like David did. I'll be honest. Defense lawyer Michael Reed described the Crown's case as absurd, saying they glossed over the killer's motive and merely pointed to an argument between Robin and David over a chainsaw. He said the defense case would be that Robin killed the other family members before killing himself. He told the jury that Robin did this because his incestuous relationship with Lynette had come to light and that she was, quote, going around telling everybody that he molested her and had come home to tell her mother about the abuse that night. Reed said that Robin, a missionary and school teacher, was depressed and his life would be ruined by the incest allegations. That's a good motive.
Yeah.
He said
that. As soon as I heard that, I was like,
like, that's the motive. But I'm a little confused. There's, like, no fingerprints on the gun from Robin.
I don't know. Maybe
he killed himself.
But then decided along the way that would be fun. You know?
He wore the gloves and then he killed Lynette and he was like, you know what? Now I'll kill myself. He took off the gloves. Or he killed Stephen. Whatever. He said that for 3 years, Robin had been living in a van behind the school and was banished to a caravan behind the house when he came home for the weekend. Lynette had stayed with him in the caravan, Reed said. The defense would call startling evidence showing Robin was a killer, including forensic evidence. Reed was scathing about the police investigation. It soon developed a one-track focus on David. He said the other leads that did not fit this picture were dropped. Reed said some of the evidence was lost, destroyed, or even collected, including blood samples from under Robin's fingernails. He said that despite a neighbor telling police about the incest allegations, quote, Lynette's diaries and letters written to her mother were destroyed, although they might have contained allegations of incest from Lynette. Testimony. A teacher of Lynette's school testified that Lynette had been very open in conversation with him, in which she said that she gave birth to a black child in Papua New Guinea after being raped. He said she later changed her story in saying that she had an abortion. Anyway, the verdict. The retrial lasted 3 months with 130 witnesses being called by the Crown, which is the prosecution, and 54 by the defense. The last evidence was presented on May 27, 2009. The jury retired for several hours the following week to consider their verdict after hearing closing statements from the prosecution and the defense and the judge's summing up. They had two questions for the judge the following morning. What are the rules of reasonable doubt? And can you please clarify your statement, it must be David, to the exclusion of Robin? The judge replied in part that they must be sure the accused was guilty after careful consideration of all evidence that the Crown case had excluded Robin as a killer He said that the reasonable doubt was an honest and reasonable uncertainty about guilt. At 4:55 p.m. on the afternoon of June 5, 2009, the jury gave their verdict. They found David Bain not guilty on all five charges. The end. Who knows who killed them?
So, I mean, I guess you can't, charge a dead man. No, you can.
You can. Right?
Huh? Can you think so? Court? Like, a court? Because how else would you charge him if not, in court?
I don't know the exact rules, but I think you could, let's say, some man went to McDonald's and killed everyone, then killed himself. You can charge, his family, I think, maybe.
See, but that's cut clean. This would need, the father to go to court because it's not, I don't know, I don't care.
Well, the father's dead, so he's, you can't really punish him after his death.
Well, yeah, but,
But it was record. It would be just to prove that he did, and I don't think you'd go to court about it.
Hmm.
But maybe.
I mean, personally, I heard the incest allegations. He was sleeping in a car. How old was the boy at this time?
David was 22.
Oh, that's not a boy, but...
No. They're all adults. I think the youngest was 17. Let me go.
I was gurgling, though. I thought that was a baby.
Sorry. No, the youngest was 14. It was Stephen.
Dude,
Stephen was 14, Lynette was 18, and Arwa was 19, and then David was the oldest, he was 22.
I was thinking 6 months, 10, and 15, but...
No, they were all teenagers.
Okay, that's kind of weird. I mean,
you're living at home, how old are you?
Yeah, but that's different. I don't know. I just have to believe that it was the father. Why would the boy do it? You didn't mention any kind of he's been torturing animals. The neighbor knew. That would be apparent if he was a psychopath.
Yeah, there's no motive. There's really no reason for him to do it. But the father does have motive, yeah. It's kind of weird that if the father did do it, that he left a note on the computer saying, you're the only one that deserved to be alive.
Maybe he was just he didn't have to be a good person. Maybe he the oldest boy, the one who lived, maybe he just sided with the father all the time, took out the trash, and he was in the moment.
Maybe the father just decided to kill everyone and David wasn't there. So he's fuck it. I guess I won't kill David. You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
who else would have done it? A stranger?
No. Anyway, all right. So it's your turn.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cirque du Freak, Vampire's Assistant.
Some parallels. Oh yeah. So elaborate.
The real case, and then the movie. There's a boy, okay, parallels. So now Darren, and then in the movie there's a younger daughter, and then she can just fill up all of the places of the other children.
Uh-huh.
And then the mother and father line up perfectly.
Great. So does the vampire kill his whole family?
Yeah. I don't know. Though that would make more sense though. Just a stranger coming into the family and making it seem all of these questions, but it was actually just someone who didn't even know the family.
But hear me out, though. Instead of it being the father, it's Josh Hutcherson's character, the villain of the movie. He comes in, and he kills the whole entire family. Yeah. That's it. That's my end statement.
And then the cops would be so shit at their job. That they don't notice all of this vampire shit, and they're just must have been the boy. But he's dead.
He's dead.
Not a dead man anyway.
This is a good comparison. Let's talk about the movie. Let's give it a little, let's do a discussion. Did you like the movie?
Yeah.
Do you remember the movie?
the most powerful scene is when the friend is like banging on the coffin and being like, how dare you leave me? Iconic.
The most iconic scene is it goes like 6 feet in the ground and he's playing his little Game Boy on the coffin.
Mm-hmm. I mean, his whole like from when he gets pushed off the roof, like the roof to be killed, to like when he's like let out of the coffin is just like iconic.
I agree completely. And,
like, who didn't like fantasize about just being turned into a vampire, faking her own death, living in a circus?
With the girl with the monkey tail, that was fun.
Yeah, I liked it. Because, like, she wasn't, like, a sexy monkey. She was just a monkey.
He was just a monkey.
It's a win.
The guy from Almost Famous was in it. He played Irvra the Snake Boy. Mm. And for the life of me, I can't remember what he was doing. Because he's also in We Bought a Zoo, but... he was a monkey guy and We Bought a Zoo, but was it just like a snake guy? Was he turned into a snake?
What was his name?
Evra the Snake Boy. His name's Patrick Fugit.
Oh, I see it. Okay.
It's next to William Dafoe.
Evra, close friends with Darren, Snake Boy.
Is he just part snake? I think he's just part snake.
Yeah. I think he just, like, looks...
like a snake? I see it now. He's the one with the scales.
Oh, yeah. He just looked like that. Yeah.
Just looked like that.
I love how, like, 99% of the images are, like, anime things that came up. Like, drawings.
Let me look. I don't see anime. Oh, now I do.
Like, do we have different Googles? No, but that's... I like how they looked in the movie, though.
The Snake Boy?
Yeah. They didn't do him dirty.
No, he looked good. He had a beanie on and everything.
Right? Like, cover your bald head.
He has hair.
Well, he shouldn't if he's a snake.
He's a snake boy, Cameron.
The boy part comes in when he has hair.
So he also looks like a boy.
No.
It's not important. I can't remember how the movie ended.
It's just like a big battle between like the bad vampires and the good
vampires.
Like, whatever his name is, Krebsley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ooh.
Rebecca
and Darren share a long, heartfelt kiss at the end of the movie.
I remember, and her monkey tail comes out, and it's just like, woo, or something.
All right.
All right. Well, this was fun.
We could have forgotten that part.
Sorry I brought it up. Well, this was fun. Do you have any last remarks? Anything you want to tell our audience?
Call in. I think it wasn't the father, but you're wrong. So.
All right. So do you want to say where, do you want them to find you on social media, or do you want to remain hidden? Do you want to say where to be found?
Yeah.
All right. What's your tag, Cameron?
Yeah, let me look it up because.
I think it's leafy.greens.
Yeah, it's leafy.greens.art.
Because she's an artist, so if anyone wants any commissions, she'd be so willing to give you some Vampire's Assistant commission.
Yeah.
Some fan art.
Code VAMPANESE for 10% off.
I hate that.
I think that's what bad vampires were called. I hate that.
VAMPANESE. Thanks everyone for listening. Follow us on all the social media platforms at Screen of the Crime, and don't kill anyone. Thank you. Bye.